Exertion number 14983, Albert Shippen, reel 6.
Mr. Shippen, reel 6. The ATS camp was adjoining your own camp. Was that out of bounds to other ranks?
Well, yes, it was out of bounds, but the main camp was divided by a road which led to a small pit village called Pagebank. You crossed that road and then there was a ravine, and that was part of the Bransworth First Class Golf Course. Then you came to the ATS camp. And there was accommodation in there for about 300 girls. Then there was another gap with another ravine and everything in that, dividing that with a castle. So in actual fact, you had about a quarter of a mile between the main camp and then the ATS camp and then the castle area. Oh yes, the very few people got into the ATS camp in any shape or form. And even when the ATS girls came for to be trained as buglers, we weren't allowed in their camp under any circumstances. And the girls used to come to our practice areas and everything like that. There was a further large contingent of ATS girls at the new college at Neville's Cross. And there, the band and bugles used to go down and do parades and that there, but that was an NCO school. The ADS girls went there for promotion to all ranks, officers and everyone and that. The main duties of the girls in the Bransworth camp were to accommodate any vacancy that arose after a soldier was taken out and was sent off to his battalion. They filled in the gaps.
So they had their own band and bugles and did their drills on your square?
No, they only had the buglers. But we used to do their parades for them up at the their staff college, as they called it. But they had their own buglers.
Having quite a number of women in the camp and close by, did that cause any problems?
Well, from what I can recollect, it's obviously there must have been some cases, but there were very few and far between, because you can just imagine the rigid discipline that was enforced, and also the fact that at that point of time, the ATS girls, who up to then had probably been volunteers, conscription came in. And of course these girls were in the same mode as the conscripts who were in the main camp. They were just adjusting themselves to army life and the rigours of discipline. So therefore I don't think there was many that would kick over the traces of the army under those circumstances. But other than that, they were fully employed at their jobs. There was very little to do for them but to carry out their duties.
You mentioned to me something about a signals pigeon loft. What was that?
Well, if you go into the castle, on the right hand side, and on the left hand side obviously, there's a tower on either side. And on the right hand tower was the guard room at the bottom. And you walked up to this tower, and at the top of this tower there was this magnificent, for those days, pigeon loft. It was run by the Royal Corps Signals, and we had a major out of the Duke of Wellington's regiment, whose name was Colin Hill, who was a pigeon fancier and was a bit of an entrepreneur in his own right, and by some quirk or other, seemed to get all the timber and nesting boxes that he required from all and sundry that was in the area. Anyway, these pigeons had names like Halifax, Spitfire, Hurricane, and Whitley, and all those kind of bombers that we had in those days, and that kind of thing. And they were trained, and then every so often there would be a small military vehicle called a UP pickup would arrive, and these pigeons would be basketed and dispatched to some far-flung outpost, and it was obviously they used them for communications. And very few people know of the existence of that pigeon off. But although I haven't seen it personally for the past few years, I am told that there is still part of it in existence in the tower.
It is strange, because First World War, yes, pigeons, but by Second World War, you'd expect some better form of communication.
Well, I think it could have been...
this was early in the war, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. This was 1941-42. I can't say authentically, but I have been told that they were used by the RAF in the case of a bomber coming down. If a bomber was crashing... they would release this pigeon with a particular message on or something, which gives them a location or something where the bomber was actually coming down at.
You've mentioned Colonel Hasted. What was he like? Did you have any time with him at all? Was he
coming? When we first joined, obviously we were all interviewed by him. And he took a particular interest in what the boys were doing, their training, and what was happening, because he saw in them their future NCOs and the future members of the regiment. It was unfortunate that he had this medical disorder, and I'm led to believe it's a mastoid and it was in his ear, and they couldn't do much for him, and it just drove him insane practically. Till one Saturday morning, we were all summoned to a scale air parade at the camp, and eventually the phone call come through to the guard room, and the bugler blew all officers, and that was announced that the colonel had shot himself.
Did he have a full military ceremony?
Yes. Oh yes, I think it was all attended to and everything like that. I didn't personally go to the funeral, I believe it was all attended to in that vein because of the circumstances of his illness.
Who succeeded him?
We got a commanding officer who had been commanding the 70th Young Soldiers Battalion, which was at... stationed at a place called Newton Aycliffe, and his name was Hughie MacBain. Not to get mixed up with the other MacBains that was in the regiment later on. Their father was the director of music to the British Army, but this one was called MacBain, and his son actually farms within spitting distance of the castle at the moment at Bransford.
What was he like?
Oh, a very tall, very elegant gentleman, always dressed in his SD and his riding breeches and his boots and everything, and looked the general officer come gentleman status and everything. He also used to take time out to come and visit the boys, section and the band of bugles, and also was very interested in people that was going to serve in the regiment at a later stage. Of course, he also played a tremendous part after Colonel Astor had shot himself in forming the 4th IDC. And then, of course, when the new progress came in, of sorting out people through personal selection and this kind of thing, he, that was another big job that they took on to sort out, because we had a bigger turnover and drafts were coming in every fortnight as usual, but the turnover was more rapid, and the fact that some of them were only with us for 6 weeks, and then documentation and travel and arrangements and posting the different units, and then vice versa, we were receiving in infantry people from other training units who had been allocated to the Durham Light Infantry and the Duke of Wellington Regiment.
Second in command, have you any memories of those?
Well, there was one called Willoughby, who he ran the Regimental Institute as well, where you could go and buy your regimental histories and your notebooks and all the paraphernalia, memorabilia, which was on sale during wartime for people to send Christmas cards and what have we. Then we had a Major McCoy. He was an ex Durham Light Infantry soldier who served in the war, in the First World War, and come out. Then we had a Captain Walker, who came from the Bishop Auckland area, who was a school teacher. And then, of course, we had a lot of people, such as Major Jackson, who was a solicitor of Swinburne and Jackson, of the local area, and Polly Watson, who was came through, being the depot, and that who was a solicitor out at Barnard Castle. Then we had people, Major Drummond, and we had Colonel Bramwell through from the 8th Battalion, Kirkup through, and then of course we had the people that was coming in and out when the battalions would return and coming to BHQs for reunion dinners. And that we had Colonel Law, who was the secretary of the DLI Association, and that responsible also for the comfort fund for the prisoners of war. And it was endless of officers going in and out. And then, as I've mentioned previously, we had Ted Short, then we had other NCOs, Billy Nicholson.
Before we come to the NCOs, and again going back to the commanders and officers that you had in the time that you were there, 1941-42, that early period, there'd be a mixed bag. There'd obviously be some that were harder or harsher than others. Does any stand out in your mind?
Well, I would think that you could safely say that the regular officers maintained the standards that they were used to in peacetime, and were very adamant about things like battalion standing orders, which had been published, and were a battalion standing order or a regimental standing order. But as the years progressed and the war progressed, we were getting territorial officers in, and also officers that had been conscripted. We had a young assistant adjutant called Gordon Robertson, who was a TA officer. Now you could tell straight away that he was a different kettle of fish to the adjutants and that we'd had who were regular officers before the war.
Which way did he differ from the regulars?
Well, you would find now that they more or less wanted everything done pedantically, regardless. You saluted correctly, you stood to attention, you didn't speak till you were spoken to. I remember once I was pulled up by an officer. I was riding a bike, one of these heavy bikes which they had in those days, which were built to last like battleships, and you had to sit to attention and pass the officer. And I, for some unknown reason, didn't. And I was called back and by this officer and asked why I didn't sit to attention as I passed him.
Do you remember his name?
I couldn't off the top of my head at the moment. I would do eventually, but I can't remember his name off the top of my head. But, you know, I just stood there rigidly to attention with the bike at the side and said, you know, something like, well, I could have fallen off, sir. And the answer was, well, you should have very well fallen off, but you should have saluted me. And those kind of remarks that was passed. But as obviously, the discipline that they maintained was, in my estimation, in order now that I look back, was much too severe for the thing that was on. I mean, you had to stand rigidly with attention to talk to a lance corporal, which was absolutely tremendous in those days.
Were there any officers who became renowned for the fact that they meted out more severe punishments than another officer would for the same offence?
Well, as I say, we had this officer called Tim McCoy. And I think he had the First World War syndrome, that you could be taken out and shot in the morning. He was quite the tyrant to himself. And we had a duck pond, which is still there, by the way, in the courtyard in the castle. And we had these ducks that had been imported by the regulars from China, and two huge peacocks. One of the punishments was you had was meted out to individuals who committed misdemeanors, was to open the empty this damned duck pond of water and swill it out and everything, and then replenish the water by bucketfuls. One of the other punishments that was meted out to people was in the castle. You can just imagine that the number of little the rooms we had with these open fires and it was tremendous to keep warm during the winter period and that. And we had these like coal dust delivered and with cement, and we had these like briquettes made down in the cellars or the dungeons and that. And you were put on extra fatigues to make these briquettes and this kind of thing, and you know, washing down the walls in these huge open spaces in the castle, in the dining room, big dining rooms, the main hall. And one of the punishments the boys used to get was we had this great big major hall, the major hall and that, with this big highly polished floor, and we used to have to bump this floor with these great big bumpers and these blankets on the bottom, and put a polish on called Ronnock, and it used to probably take you at least 2 to 3 hours to do it.
You mentioned there was quite a movement of officers, so presumably they were coming to the depot for a period of time, then they would go off into possibly active service.
Well, and the officers used to come in, and they used to be sent up to the camp, and used to do the platoon training with the platoons. And as the platoons were posted out to the battalions, the officers, 9 times out of 10, went with them. But the instructors, they very rarely went out unless there was absolute emergency. But the officers that was coming through, they were coming through learning the new weapons, because we were bringing in, I mean, the 2-pound anti-tank gun then. They were bringing in the new machine guns, the Brens with the pans on instead of just the magazines. They were also devising new tactics and this kind of, and this was revolutionizing everything as it goes along. And of course, with it being an infantry training unit, the experimenting wing, where these people came along to see what the needed substance to carry out these exercises, the new tactics were coming in, and of course the officers were being revised all the time. And of course in those days as well, one of the big things was frightened of paratroopers and airborne forces coming in. And of course one of the things we spent a lot of time on, particularly in our section, the bugles and that, was aircraft recognition.
So you had a defensive role as well as the ceremonial role.
Oh yes, yes. We were the aircraft section kind of thing. We used to, as soon as the sirens and all that went, we went onto the roofs or wherever we were with binoculars and watched for all the any aircraft coming in.
Who was the senior commander, if that's the right word, of the band bugles?
Well, we had a bandmaster called Frankie Rose.
What rank did he
have? Well, he's a WO1, but his appointment was the bandmaster. And then, of course, we had a band sergeant in those days, very nice chap, called Arthur Plumley, who, as a boy, had been in the Afghan War, and he was the band sergeant. And then we had quite a number of NCOs that had come from the 1st and 2nd Battalion bands. But also in the band, there was quite a lot of boy soldiers who, at 17 and a half, had gone and done the 3 months training as infantrymen. But because of the musical skills and being good musicians, were posted back to the band and didn't go forward to the Young Soldiers Battalion. If you were no good as a bugler or a bandsman, well, you would go and do your 3 months training and be sent off to School Aycliffe to join the 70th Battalion. But if you were a good bugler or a good bandsman, well, you'd be posted back to the band and bugles.
What was your bandmaster like?
Oh, they were musically, that was their love. That was their first love. The band sergeant major and the bugle major were the disciplinarians and the people to drill you and that. Bandmasters were more inclined to take the musical side of the... and that singer's name was called Armitage. I just remembered every time. Armitage's surname was, and he was attached to the band, and he was a singer in the band, which was unusual.
Were there any of the NCOs in the band who you didn't like for any reason?
No, I think if you look at the military band, no matter where they were, they were all musicians, and I think that was their first love. And the military side of it was secondary to them. As long as you turned out reasonably well, and you weren't causing any bother, and that, they were quite good chaps. In fact, they would be more than generous. If we went away anywhere or something like that, they'd come and make sure that you weren't left out of things, and they would look after you, and they would ensure that you had enough blanco to do your belt, and see if you had metal polish and that, and even give you tins of stuff and that. And, you know, and you'd probably reciprocate by saying, well, I'll clean your belt and gate. And no, it doesn't matter, you know, I'll do it myself. But there you are. They were different to what, when I went to the 1st Battalion eventually, to what the soldier side was. They were musicians, and that's all they wanted to do, was play the musical instruments and become perfectionists in their own right. a lot of them, strangers in the museum, left the Durham Light Infantry and went off to staff bands, the RASC staff band, the Blues and Royals and the Royal Artillery and people like that, where there was more scope for them as being staff bands and more promotion for them in this kind of thing was being in a line regiment.
Do you have any outstanding memories of the band bugle ranks like yourself, boys and men, who stand out in your memory from this period of time that we're discussing?
Well, I think you would safely say people like Frankie Murley and a chap called George Pratt and a chap called Blakely. Now, Blakely, now there's a case. He was in the Bertram Mills Circus Band before the war, and then when he was called up, came to the 4th ITC Band, and he communicated with Arthur Plumley, who was the bandmaster, sorry, the band sergeant major, for quite some time. He died about 3 or 4 years ago, and he thoroughly enjoyed himself, but he was a musician, and that's all they wanted to do. And the other ones, Parker, he went on to the RASC staff band. Merle and Pratt went to the Blues and Royals. And a chap called 1-4, he went off to the staff band, the Royal Artillery, as a sergeant. Collins, he stopped with us. And he finished his time. He did about 21 years with the regiment, ended up a sergeant. Bill Thompson, he was a boy soldier, and that. He ended up the band sergeant major. Another lad called Eric Broadley, he went away and became a bandmaster in his own right. He came from Darlington, a nice chap. From that, the majority of them did very well, but the one that sticks out mostly, that achieved the most, I remember, was a chap called George Crowhurst. Now, he came to us as a bandmaster, a very, very efficient bandmaster and a musician, 100%. Now, he'd been attached to the Royal Artillery staff band in Arsenal, his bandmaster was a bandmaster, a very renowned military bandmaster called Geary, Lieutenant Colonel Geary. And after Crowhurst had been with us for about 3 or 4 years, he decided to leave the Durham Light Infantry, and he went across to Borneo, where he took up a position as the military advisor to the richest man in the world, which was the Sultan of Brunei. And the band sergeant major, as he was then known, when I joined the regiment in 1941, he was the band sergeant, Arthur Plumley. And when I became the bugle major, we became very good friends, even though the age gap was quite considerable. And the three of us kept in contact for many, many years. Unfortunately, they're both dead now. And he used to tell me about the Sultan of Brunei, who used to think the world of his band and everything. And he could spend money. Nothing was a bother to him. He used to go to the Sultan. He was one of the few people that had access to the Sultan without seeing any of his advisors. And he could go and buy instruments and uniforms as a whim and fly back to England and sort out music and everything. So he was the most famous one of the band that I can ever. And he ended up equivalent in rank to a lieutenant colonel, which would be a director of music in the British Army.
What period of time was he with the band, your band?
Oh, about, I would think, close on 8 to 10 years, just off the top of my head.
When did he first come?
He came to us just as the war was finishing. just as the war was finishing, he came to us when Rose, who was then quite old and had his demob number and that, he went and Quest came and took his place.
Were any of the boys in your memory who failed and were taken away? In your group, you know, didn't come up to scratch or
wrote
the copybook or what have you?
Oh yes, we had. We've got one that lives a quarter of a mile away from me now. He's his name's Arthur Wynne, and he just committed one misdemeanor after another and got himself in into trouble in this kind of thing. And when he'd done his 3 months training, off they shot him off to Felton holding unit. There was another one called Oxley. He came out of the Gordon Boys, actually, been in the Gordon Boys school, and he went away. And we had two Duke of Wellington boys attached to us.